This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Downs, our producer, and your number is 877-217-5757. Emails go to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're pleased to begin today with Julie Farnham. She served as assistant and then acting director of intelligence for the United States Capitol Police during one of the most tumultuous periods in our country's history. During her time, she oversaw the identification and vetting of nearly 20,000 threats against members of Congress, most of which were made by United States citizens who adhered to extremist ideologies. Her book is Domestic Darkness, an insider's account of the January 6th insurrection and the future of right-wing extremism. Julie Farnham served with the Department of Homeland Security for more than 15 years, and she is a person who knows her way around the Capitol, and she warned of the insurrection that might happen and did occur on January 6, 2021. Julie, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to be with you. What do you think the reason was that your warnings were not heeded, that they were largely ignored? What happened?
I think it's a few things. One, you know, the Capitol Police deal with protests almost every day. It's really their bread and butter. So I think there is a level of complacency and arrogance, like, we've got this, we know how to handle this. We've dealt with other protests, including the ones that happened in November and also December. And those essentially went on without a hitch. And so they were expecting a lot of the same, even though the intelligence suggested that it was going to be quite dangerous. And this time around in December, or in January, excuse me, Congress itself was going to be the target.
Well, what happened on the ground that day? Could you see it coming?
We could. When I arrived in the office that morning early, I was already seeing protesters there. And we saw, you know, a lot of intelligence leading up to that day with indicating that people were going to be coming armed, that people were going to be targeting members of Congress specifically with violence, and things were going to get out of control. And that is something that was communicated up the chain. And unfortunately, they did not prepare appropriately. They didn't cancel leave for officers. So at the height of the fighting, there were only about 65% of the officers were there on the ground. The others were on leave. And also prior to January 6th, the Capitol Police did not call in any of the neighboring jurisdictions to be there that day. I know there's been a lot of talk about the National Guard and them not being there, but National Guard aside, Capitol Police had the ability to get other jurisdictions from, you know, Arlington, Virginia, and Alexandria, and places in Maryland to come in and be there that day, and they weren't called upon until things were at the height of the violence.
The book is Domestic Darkness, an insider's account of the January 6th insurrection and the future of right-wing extremism. We're talking with Julie Farnham, who ended up being director of intelligence for the United States Capitol Police. Now, as bad as it was, and there's no doubt it was horrible, it could have been much worse. Were you fearful that people in high places would be assassinated? Was it at that point?
Yeah, absolutely it was. You know, we saw the violence, and it certainly could have been much worse. It's a credit to the officers who were fighting that more of them did not use lethal force, because there were definitely times where they felt their lives were threatened. And also just with the mob and so many people with weapons, it's fortunate that there weren't more deaths and more injuries. There were, you know, 5 deaths altogether on that day. But it could have been considerably worse, particularly if the members of Congress had not been evacuated or were not able to evacuate and had confrontations with the rioters. Certainly could have been much worse.
Julie, a listener asks, this is Tom on Bluebonnet, about the distinction between rank and file conservatives and what we're referring to as right-wing extremists. There are extremists on all sides of the political spectrum, but Are there distinctions among these far right groups? I gather they're not exactly monolithic either when you compare the Oath Keepers with the Proud Boys and QAnon and white supremacists. What are the general things that they have in common and some of the things they don't?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think he brings up a good point, too. You know, there are a lot of good people and also bad people on both sides of the political aisle. And really, I'm just concentrating on the extremist elements, but I don't want that to be construed as, you know, all people from one party or another party are good or bad. Because, like I said, there's bad on both sides and good on both sides. But yeah, to your point, there were a few different groups that were prominent there, QAnon being one of them, militia groups such as, you know, the Oath Keepers, white supremacist groups, Proud Boys. So they vary more in their ideologies and what they believe in and what they're fighting for. On this day, we saw them come together to fight for a common cause with relations to the election. But, you know, some of the white supremacist groups tend to be more violent and more hateful. QAnon tends to have, you know, a different ideology, and they have different things that mm-hmm. concern them. But, you know, they all came together, as I mentioned, for a common cause that day. But, you know, fundamentally, they believe in different things and they are fighting for different reasons.
You note, and I mentioned in the lead into our discussion, that there were 20,000 threats against members of Congress over the last few years, and most of them yeah. made by U.S. citizens. And as we yeah. know, it only takes one person to change the world in a horrible way. How much of a concern is this?
It's a huge concern. Capitol Police is a relatively small police force. I mean, they're bigger than, you know, some small towns, but for the amount of work that they have to do and their mission, they're relatively small, and they have a relatively small team to investigate these threats. And as you mentioned, there's been tens of thousands of threats against members of Congress, and being able to triage those threats and determine which ones are serious and which ones should be prosecuted is a challenge. And I think, you know, Capitol Police really needs to look at how it interacts with others and what their mission is and what they should be focusing on. Because they not only protect, you know, all 535 members of Congress by monitoring threats and things like that, but they have to protect the buildings as well. And so something to think about or something to consider is that perhaps maybe the Capitol Police should divide their protections of people versus protections of buildings and give focus to that, because only 10 members of Congress actually get personal protective details. And those are, you know, the leadership on both parties in both the House and the Senate. But everyone else, they don't have protective details. And there are significant threats, as you mentioned.
You state that Capitol Police have misled Congress. How so?
Yes. After January 6th, there was testimony from the Capitol Police that took some of the things that Capitol Police were doing unrelated to January 6th and presented it as evidence that the Capitol Police had been prepared and prepared for the worst, when that just wasn't true. Examples of that is my team, the Intelligence and Interagency Coordination Division. It was stated that we moved to a 24/7 operational posture. That wasn't true. We had been 24/7 for many months before January 6th. So that move had nothing to do with January 6th. And there were other indications about staffing and security at members' houses and things like that that were implemented unrelated to January 6th. And so really, they misled Congress in the way they stated that.
You reveal in your book that you had a relationship with someone who turned out to have a connection to the Proud Boys. This has to be embarrassing, and I commend you for your candor. But do you think this man was using you to get information?
I don't know. I've thought about that, you know, a lot. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, to be honest. It's unfortunate. And I think most people can relate to having a relationship with someone, whether it be romantic or friendship, and that person not turning out to be the person that you thought they were. And so it's sad, it's hurtful. I hope he didn't use me just for information, but given what has come out since then, it's possible.
The book is Domestic Darkness, and it is a true insider's account of the January 6th insurrection and the future of right-wing extremism. That's the subtitle, from Julie Farnham, who served as assistant and then acting director of intelligence for the United States Capitol Police. We'll spend a few more minutes with her, and then we'll hear from Troy Hebert, who is a former state lawmaker, served in both chambers, and has some thoughts about where the state is headed under the leadership of his former nemesis turned friend, Governor-elect Jeffrey Martin Landry. We'll be back after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. We're visiting for a few more minutes with Julie Farnham. Her book is Domestic Darkness. It's about the January 6th insurrection. Robin Dow producing, and she is imposing the 20-second rule for callers. Wait, that's how much time you have to get in your question. We are short on time, and we'd like to get to a few of you, and then we'll move on to Troy Hebert, always a captivating presence on this show. Let's go to Patricia in Magnolia Woods. Patricia, I know you've been waiting a while. You're on with Julie.
Good morning. Right after January 6th, from the reports that came out, I got the impression that Washington, D.C.'s relatively strict gun laws, like against open carry, helped to prevent some of the violence.
Is that accurate, Julie?
Yes and no. I mean, I think people still carried weapons in there. I don't think a lot of people were paying attention to many of the laws that day. so, I mean, for those that were aware of the strict laws, maybe that prevented them. But I would say generally, no. I think plenty of people brought weapons in that day.
All right, Jim on I-12. Jim, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. And one, thank you very much for your service. What did you see in the way of any types of interference or pressure or maybe aiding and abetting from Congress and the administration?
All right. Was that going on? Was there actual encouragement for these people to do what they were doing from people in high places?
Potentially, yeah. I think there was some of that. I think there was some of it behind the scenes. I know that there were members of Congress who were aware of the threat, but didn't speak out against it. And so that's problematic. I also think there was, you know, maybe withholding of information at some level from others, you know, within Congress that maybe hindered some of the decision-making processes on that day.
David in Atlanta. David, you're on.
Good morning. Was the shooting of Ashley Babbitt justified, and if so, why?
All right. What about that much dark ballyhooed incident?
I think it probably was, because behind the lieutenant who did the shooting, there were several members of Congress who are being evacuated. And I think had that mob, not just Ashley Babbitt, but the mob standing behind her as well, had they breached that door and got a hold of members of Congress, I think things would have gotten much worse that day.
Patrick in Ennis-Wald Estates. Hello, Patrick. You're on.
Hey, being from Baton Rouge, we had three police officers killed back in 2016. And I get that that wasn't BLM, but what about the BLM riots? Was that an insurrection?
All right. Well, that's not related to this, and I don't think they're equitable at all. But, Julie, he asked you the question, not me.
So, you know, I wasn't at the Capitol during that summer, but I do think, you know, people should be able to protest peacefully, regardless of what they're protesting about. And they should be behaving lawfully on all occasions. You know, I can understand why people are protesting, and racial injustice is something that people should speak out about, but protests should be peaceful. And that's the best way, I think, to get your point across.
What are your fears, if any, about next year? Could this be an encore, an unfortunate encore?
Yeah, I do think so. I don't think we would have something like we saw on January 6th, just because people, know that threat and can be prepared for that threat. I'm more concerned about violence against specific elected officials, more targeted violence, the lone wolf coming out to commit violence. That, I think, is probably the bigger concern.
The book is Domestic Darkness, an important book from a true insider. She was director of intelligence for the U.S. Capitol Police, and she was there on January 6, 2021. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate your time and your candor, Julie Farnham.
Thank you.
And now we turn the page, and we are visiting with Troy Hebert, longtime Louisiana Politico, and 16 years ago, he beat Jeff Landry in a close race. They were running for a legislative seat, and Troy Hebert prevailed. He's talked on this show about what a grueling campaign it was, and he found out from a front row seat how tough Jeff Landry is when he is in a race for a job he wants. And on October 14th, Troy Hebert, I think, was the first person to call it. He did this 6 months ago. He said Landry was going to win without a runoff, and I must say I thought he was wrong. I thought Landry would win the race, win the election, but I sure was surprised when he won without going to the post a second time. And congratulations to you, Troy Hebert. And it is remarkable not only that he won, but the fact that he took it to you and you did not take it personally. You're now friends. So what's going on with the governor-elect? And what do you make of the fact that he won in a low-turnout election? Is this a mandate?
Well, first, good morning, Jim, to you and your listeners. You know, back then when I made that prediction, when everybody, I think, disagreed with that, I mean, you know, because I know Governor Landry personally, and I just know how tenacious he is and how focused he is, I just saw him being a hell of a candidate. And on top of that, I also saw that the field was just extra weak. And I don't think at any time they actually posed a threat to him. And in fact, as I said on your show before, you know, the thing about Jeff Landry, when you take Jeff Landry on, you got to remember that he's going to, you might not remember what you did in the second grade, but he's going to remind you what you did in the second grade. And what I mean by that is he does his homework and he will take it to you. Okay. He's not going to hit you in the back. He's going to punch you right in the face. And my point about the governor's race and why I called it that he would win is that it goes to show you how weak the field of opponents were. He never once that I saw had to use that tactic in his toolbox of actually attacking somebody. I don't think he took any of them on, and he just saved that sledgehammer that he had in his toolbox, and he never had to take it out, and he just ran a positive campaign and talked about the issues, and the voters rewarded him.
Well, he also had at least $12 million, and he had others spending money on his behalf. He had the Republican Party hierarchy in our state in his corner and the former president, Donald Trump. So he had an amazing organization, and Sean Wilson, who was the Democratic standard bearer, he acknowledged in a New York Times piece a few days ago that he spent all of $300,000. Now, that truly is David against a Goliath, and Sean Wilson, he got 26%. I wasn't all that surprised at his number. I thought that would be about where he would be. Now, others thought he would get more, but I was right about Wilson, but I thought Wagglesback and Lundy and Schroeder and Hewitt would get more of the vote. Hewitt didn't even finish in the top five. Top six. She lost to another Democrat. So what happened with those others who were running as conservative alternatives to Landry?
Well, I want to dispel one rumor that was out there right quick. And the math will do that is that there was a lot of talk by some of the other candidates that said, you know, if Sean Wilson wouldn't be in the race, or let's just say that the Democrats set out of the race, that they could actually beat Jeff that way, because then they could enjoy the fruits of the Democratic base. Well, simple math tells you if Mr. Wilson wasn't in that race, we would still have Governor Landry.
Well, and he would have won by an even bigger margin. But
exactly. So the fact about the Democratic vote, I think, has been taken advantage of. And look, I'm talking because I want your listeners to know I'm an independent, but you know I'm conservative.
And
but
former Democrat.
Yeah, I was a Democrat. I was elected as a Democrat five out of five times. And so I can say this. I think some of the Democrats out there, including in the black community, are starting to wake up to this business about the Democratic Party just counting on them to show up for them. And I think when they look around and see the crime in the big cities, our poor educational system, and all the things that disproportionately affect the black community, I think there's a large number of them that's starting to say, wait a minute, these people are taking us for granted. They're taking advantage of us. And I think you see, I don't know what the percentages are, maybe you can tell us, Jim, but I think Governor Landry enjoyed a pretty good amount of support from the black community.
I think he got about 12%. And Wilson got about 80% based on the numbers that I've crunched. And all the others got about 8%. And that included the other Democrat and Hunter Lundy and all the others. And when you look at the, generally a Democrat should get about 95% of the black vote. And this time it didn't happen with a black candidate. We'll talk more with Troy Abear after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Troy Abear is with us, an independent former Democrat. As you heard him say, he won five elections as a Democrat, and one of those was against Jeff Landry in 2007. Landry lost that election, but then he went big. He won a congressional race, and then he got his seat zeroed out, and so he had to run against Charlie Bustani, basically in Bustani's district, and he lost that one. And then he was looking for a place to land, and he ran for attorney general. He was expected to lose that race to Buddy Caldwell, who was a former Democrat. But Landry won it by getting a lion's share of the black vote. And he did so with support from people like Cleo Fields, who liked him better than they liked Buddy Caldwell. And he served two terms, and now he is the governor-elect of Louisiana. And the way things have gone, we had 8 years of Bobby Jindal and 8 years of John Bel Edwards. Jeff Landry is now the odds-on favorite to be governor for the next 8 years, if he so desires. Now, he is an ambitious man, as governors are often, well, some would say guilty of. Bobby Jindal was guilty for trying to be president while he was governor. I don't think Jeff Landry will have his eye on the White House, but he does have a major, major supporter in Donald Trump, who right now, according to Vegas odds, is the favorite to win the presidency in 2024. What would happen, Troy Abear, if his friend Donald Trump got elected president? Would there be a spot at the table for Jeff Landry if he wanted it?
Well, I'm going to go way out on this limb, Jim, on your show, like I did about predicting Jeff winning. My crystal ball tells me that when Donald Trump wins for president, when he wins for president, he's going to want to appoint Governor Landry as the next attorney general. And let me tell you my thinking on that. I think issue number one for President Trump will be payback. He's going to pay back a lot of people that put him and his family through a lot of stuff that, whether you like him or not, I think some of it's a bunch of bull, but regardless. And I couldn't think of a more powerful, astute player than Governor Landry to become the attorney general. And for two reasons. Number one, I think he is a very loyal person, and I think President Trump recognizes that in Governor Landry. And number two, when it comes after going after people and taking care of business, I think Governor Landry is about the best one there is. And I think, you know, he's a bulldog, he's a fighter, he's smart, he knows how to handle things. And I think President Trump's gonna offer it to him. Now, the question is that I can't predict is the newly elected governor of Louisiana, is he gonna, you know, go to Washington so soon? It's gonna be a tough decision for him. But I want to just prepare him. If he don't know that President Trump's gonna offer it to him, I want to tell him that right now. I bet you a dollar to a dime he does.
Well, he would be a good fit, but there's a lot of things that have to happen for that offer to be made. And number one, Trump has to stay out of jail. He has to also be reelected. And I don't know that either of those will happen. Now, when I say he's the favorite with 34%, meaning that the Vegas odds say there's a 66% chance it'll be somebody else, but Biden's only at 30%. So Will there be somebody coming in the next 11 and a half months? I don't know. But you heard it here first. Troy Hebert says Jeff Landry would be offered the attorney general's job under President Trump. And you're right. It would be a good fit. Jake and Amy. Jake, good morning. You're on with Troy.
Good morning. Troy, as a former Democrat, why do you think John Bel Edwards chose Katie Bernhardt, who's clearly incompetent, to lead the Democratic Party?
Did John Bel Edwards choose her, and is she incompetent? You're a former Democrat. Democrats are reeling, but is it Katie Bernhardt's fault, or is it just a trend that cannot be stopped?
Well, you know, politicians always like to have an answer to questions, but on this one, I really can't. I don't know Katie Bernhardt. I really can't speak to that. I don't know her, and I don't know why. I wish I'd have a better answer than that, but I just want to be truthful.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Troy Hebert. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jim. Well, we kind of know that as Attorney General, Mr. Landry failed to protect our state. He will not ban the AR-15. He won't do anything about the next COVID-19 epidemic that will be coming, and maybe.
All right. Well, he would not be alone on the AR-15. His opinion is shared by Governor John Bel Edwards, who's a Democrat, last time I checked. And he will be with us tomorrow for his next to last Ask the Governor show, 2 o'clock. You might want to listen. I'm sure it'll be interesting. But as we look at Washington politics, suddenly Louisiana is large and in charge. And Mike Johnson, whether you like him or not, he is an impressive guy when he gave the oath of office to the new congressman from Rhode Island yesterday. I was proud for our state. I think he looks the part. He sounds the part. He is what some of us might think out of the mainstream on some issues. But Troy Hebert, I never would have thought that we would have, and that's why I'm not discounting what you're saying about Landry. I wouldn't have thought we would have Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House. I'd say the odds would have been about 1 million to 1 a year ago. And Steve Scalise is the number two person in the Republican majority. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, I know you have a nationwide audience, Jim, so let me make this statement to the rest of America, that Louisiana may be last in everything, but not when it comes to our politicians. Obviously, we're by far ahead of the pack, having the people that you talked about in charge. And so when it comes to producing some of the best politicians in the country, possibly the world, Louisiana has the right DNA. And what you said about Mike Johnson, I couldn't agree more. He's just a clean-cut, sharp individual. Of course, I have to say, you know, my former roommate in the House and Senate was Steve Scalise. And so certainly I was pulling for him and hoping he'd have got the gavel. I certainly think that not only did he deserve it, but he'd have done a great job. But, hey, that's politics. And if we couldn't have Scalise, then Johnson is our guy. And I know he's going to make Louisiana proud and hopefully, you know, bring this country around. Because, God, what a tough job trying to herd 434 cats over there in the House of Representatives.
In Louisiana, we're headed for congressional redistricting, and it appears there will be a second minority district. And so somebody has to get nailed, as they say. And some people are saying that Garrett Graves played all the wrong cards over the last few months, backing Stephen Wagasback against Jeff Landry, and then not getting fully on board. I think he did at the end, but he didn't get fully on board when Steve Scalise had the early shot at becoming Speaker of the House. So is Graves going to be the odd man out, or what do you make of that?
Well, let me say this. I learned this in my political career. You know, sometimes you're the bug, sometimes you're the windshield. And I think Mr. Graves could possibly be the bug in this one because he played the windshield card, and, I think he went against Scalise. I think he made some tough choices, and he made the wrong decisions. And so if I had to bet, my crystal ball also says that he's probably going to be the guy on the chopping block, and there's only going to be one guy that he can blame. And that's himself. Not to mention, you have to remember, I'm sure that Governor Landry probably is not going to cry if he got cut, because we both know, and a lot of your listeners have heard how, you know, Graves talked about running against him. And when he didn't run against him, he convinced his good friend Stephen Wagasback to quit a $600,000 a year job to run against Governor Landry. So I'll tell you what, I don't know what Vegas is saying on Gary Graves, but I'll tell you what, if you want to make a few dollars, I would bet against him. Mm-hmm.
Is Clay Higgins your congressman?
He is, yeah.
Okay, well, what if Graves loses, let's say he loses the majority he has in Baton Rouge, and that would be pretty easy to do with redistricting, and Baton Rouge would be whole, which it should be, as the center of the state and the largest parish. But let's say, you don't have to live in the district to run for Congress. What if Graves challenged Higgins in Acadiana? Would he have any kind of chance at all?
I think Higgins would beat him like a redheaded stepchild.
Really?
Yeah, I really do. Higgins is a very, very, very popular in Acadiana. Graves' style of politics isn't, and I don't even think it would be a race. Now, he can try, but I think O'Higgins would whip up on him.
Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Hello, Carol. You're on with Troy Hebert.
Yes, first of all, Landry's not governor yet, so don't torture us yet. And then second of all, we got to stop treating these fascists like Trump as normal. This is getting dangerous, and the country is going to suffer greatly if that man goes back in office. And just the media, like Jim, needs to wake up.
Okay. Well, one thing I can rest assured in saying is that if Trump's on the ballot, turnout will be higher. Double the number of people voted in the 2020 presidential election in Louisiana as voted in the governor's election. So Trump has strong support and strong detractors like Carol and Jefferson Terrace. But in Louisiana, Troy, the supporters outnumber the detractors.
Well, with all due respect to your caller, when he says that if Trump gets elected, things are going to get bad. I mean, how much worse can they get than they are now? We have two major wars going on in the world. America is probably least respected than it's been in a very long time.
Okay, well,
inflation's in double digits.
All right, it's not in double digits, but it's higher than it was. But of course, there's some other economic indicators that are quite good. But are we headed for a showdown on the 17th, or can Congress, led by the U.S. House, led by Mike Johnson, come to an agreement with the Biden administration to keep the government rolling?
Well, this is one of the problems. Again, look, I'm in the middle. I'm an independent guy, and the problem I see with both parties is that they both want what they want, but they never want to meet in the middle. And of course, so what happens is that the Republicans want to cut back, and the Democrats want to spin. I'm just generalizing, but for the most part. And so what happens is because of the control of the body over there in the Senate, the Democrats usually get their way. That's what's happened in the past. So why can't they meet in the middle somewhere?
Well,
you know, Jim,
right.
It doesn't always have to be all or
all
nothing.
Right. But I would remind you that the deficits the country has experienced, which has led to the record debt, the biggest ones occurred under Republican presidents. We'll be back. Thank you, Troy. Always a pleasure. We're back after this. Greatest song in history, according to Rolling Stone. And so why are we leading with Ray Charles as we segue to Mike Shepherd, the head of the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame? Because Thursday night at the Texas Club, Ray Charles. He recorded that song in 1958, a year I know well. LSU won the national championship, and I was born, and Ray Charles recorded it. It actually became a hit in 59, but the 10th greatest song of all time, according to Rolling Stone. He's going to be inducted in the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame at the Texas Club, 7 o'clock Thursday night, and we'll get to some of the others, but why Ray Charles? He had connections to all of us, but what's his connection to Louisiana, Mike Shepard?
Ray cut his first recordings in New Orleans with Cosmo Matassa. A song called Mess Around. You've probably heard it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And those are the only Ray Charles recordings ever on Atlantic Records. Everything else on ABC Paramount.
Well, Thursday night's going to be a big event for the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame. Ray Charles is a worthy inductee, and Mike Shepard has just explained why. And another inductee will be one Johnny Cash. Now, he was from neighboring Arkansas and spent a lot of time in Louisiana through the years. What's his association with our state?
He spent a lot of time as a star of the Louisiana Hayride in Shreveport, very close to Arkansas.
Yeah, very close. And he and Elvis Presley were of the same vintage. Actually, Johnny was a little bit older. It's hard to believe he's been dead 20 years, and Elvis has now been dead for 46 years.
Yep.
But they both had Louisiana roots, and Elvis is in the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and the day after I inducted him into the Hall of Fame at the Municipal Auditorium in Shreveport, I got one call from three people in Memphis.
Yeah.
On the same line, three officials of EPE, Elvis Presley Enterprises, saying, hey, man, great, thank you, you get it, you understand.
There you go. Okay. Well, as I mentioned, there are a few people on the ballot, shall we say, Thursday night at the Texas Club. They've all been voted in. But one of those is a guy named Keith Thibodeau, who I interviewed many years ago in 1989 when Lucille Ball died. And the reason is because this guy from Baton Rouge, he was Little Ricky. And people thought he was actually Lucille Ball's son. And at that time, we're talking 1951 to 57, the number one show during that period in the early days of television was I Love Lucy. And it is, still see the old reruns, but Keith Thibodeau, he was not her son. Desi Arnaz Jr. was her son, but many people thought he was.
Keith is the only survivor of the I Love Lucy show. He's the only living survivor.
It has been a little while, Mike.
Yeah. He's 72, and he was young when he started.
Yeah, I would say so. He was an infant. Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz, Vivian Vance, William Frawley, who dropped dead walking across Hollywood Boulevard. He was in My Three Sons as well. And Keith Thibodeau, who is 72 years old and is active in the music industry. And that explains, I think, one of the reasons why he is in the Music Hall of Fame.
Right. He was always active, playing drums, of course. But he was with a group in the 60s called Little David and the Giants.
Little David and the Giants.
Had a lot of hits. They were tending to be a British group. And it was David and his two twin brothers, Claiborne and Rayburn, and Keith. They all sang. They had great harmony. It was like the Beach Boys, three brothers.
Now, he'll be there, right?
Yes.
He'll be there Thursday night. And there are some others, but the other huge, huge, huge name is Dolly Rebecca Parton. A friend of mine, Mark Calvert, the other day we were at lunch, and he said, the five greatest female vocalists, and I named Dolly Parton as one of my five. And she's had a long career, going back to the late 60s with Porter Wagoner, and then she branched out on her own. She did pretty good, didn't she?
Yeah, and she actually recorded her first songs in Lake Charles in 1960. She was 12 years old.
Well, she would have been 14. She was born in 46. But hey, 1960 is pretty early in the game. The year John Kennedy was elected president, it's hard to believe Dolly could be around that long. It's hard to believe that both Dolly and Cher are 77 years old, too.
Yeah.
And they both look great. That gives us hope, Mike. That gives us hope. But I once told Dale Brown, I think when he turned 70, that I said, I'd sure like to look like you when I'm 70. He says, you don't look like me right now. They are forces of nature and freaks of nature. They just don't age. And, of course, they probably have had a little help along the way, but nothing wrong with that. But Dolly Parton, Lake Charles, Louisiana, 1960. Not many people know that one. How did you find out about that?
I've known that for a long time. I inducted Eddie Shuler into the Hall of Fame years ago, who owned Gold Band Records in Lake Charles.
Well, Mike has written about his life and times, and we had him on when his fine book came out a few years ago, Shepherding the Music. And for those who would like more information about many of the luminaries who are in the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame, Mike Shepherd, your book is available in certain places. I want to make sure that you give people the opportunity to know where to pick it up. It is a fantastic read and certainly a history of music and Louisiana's connection to music like few, if any, others. How do we get it if we haven't already gotten a copy or two?
The easiest way is on the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame or LMHOF.org website, mm-hmm. on the front page. And I will have some with me Thursday night.
Okay. Well, a listener asks, and by the way, if you'd like to get in, 877-217-5757, asks about the kiosk at the airport. That's been there for about 10 years now, hasn't it?
If you call it a kiosk, I call it a wall.
Well, yeah, it's a wall. You can't miss it. It's in a prominent place.
You can't miss it. Nobody,
and I know you worked hard to make it happen, too.
Nobody's heard it yet.
Nobody's heard it.
Well, nobody's banged into it?
No.
Hurt themselves on it?
But people stop and look, and they should, because Louisiana, as Troy Hebert said in the previous segment, we outpunch our weight when it comes to our political players, but music, I think we do even more so in the music world.
I heard that statement by him, and he's right. But the reason Dolly was here, the reason Randy Travis was here, is they came to Louisiana, they were drawn to it by all the music we had. We started the soundtrack of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
plain and simple.
Yeah, and there are just so many legends here. Years ago, I was interviewing Johnny Rivers, and I'd promoted him heavily, and he had a conflict. And to his credit, he didn't blow me off. He called and he said, "I just can't make it today, Jim, but I'll do it, but not today." I said, "Well, we're an hour from showtime. What can you do for me?" He says, "I'll get you James Burton." That was a pretty good replacement, wasn't it?
Brought James from Freeport.
Yep, and many, many. And we're not just talking about New Orleans and Baton Rouge. We're talking about the whole state has produced music people of great renown.
Jim, I was born in Shreveport, and a lot of people, when I took the hall, founded the Hall of Fame, they said, "You can spend all your time in New Orleans." I said, "No, I'm spending all my time in the Diagonals."
There you go.
The Hayride in Shreveport, the R&B in New Orleans.
Well, Robin Dow has chosen one of Dolly Parton's great songs, and who knows, she might show up Thursday night, Texas Club, 7 o'clock. She'll be inducted in the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame, and here's Dolly.
I am a seeker, a poor, sinful creature. There is none weaker than I am. Seeker, and you are a teacher, you are a reacher, so reach down, reach out and lead me, guide me and keep me in the shelter of your care each day. Won't you show me the way? I am a vessel that's empty and useless. I am a bad seed that fell by the way. I am a loser that wants to be a winner. You sinful creature, there is no weaker than I am. I am a seeker, and you are a teacher.
All right, Robin Dow closing it out with one Dolly Rebecca Parton, and she wrote that song too, 1975. She'll be inducted in the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame Thursday night. Stay tuned.